I'm sitting here as a massage therapist with all my candles and my cleansing tools, and it's like, you can't cleanse predators out of a home. It's not how abuse works.
You need a fucking exorcism. You
yeah,
need,
exactly.
I mean, to pull that devil out of the human that's possessed him to molest children, that's an exorcism, like not energy, not an energy cleanse, not a crystal ceremony. No, we need to drag that fucking demon out of the human that made him dirty. Yeah.
You're listening to Alchemical Voices, a podcast exploring the lives of BIPOC, transracial adoptees, and survivors of complex trauma. Hi, I'm Jaslyn, your host, a nurse, and trauma release practitioner, curiously observing the human experience. As a Black woman and survivor of human trafficking, I've encountered many, many hardships. On the road to recovery, I discovered that storytelling unites us at heart and is where we find healing, inspiration, and encouragement. In each episode, you'll hear stories from courageous souls, and we will touch on subjects such as identity confusion, the impacts of racism, complex trauma, transracial adoption, and much more. How do we rise amid trials and tribulations? How do we invite softness into our lives? We touch on these and many other questions, so tune in to experience transformative storytelling and let's heal together.
Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Alchemical Voices podcast. Today I have Monica Misura in the studio, and I am so excited for this gorgeous woman to be here and to reclaim her power by telling her story. Welcome, Monica.
Thank you so much, Jaslyn. And I would not be here doing this without your power and reclaiming your own story and you highlighting other people in the way that they want to be highlighted and the way that they want to tell their stories. Because for so many complex trauma survivors, we have been made to believe, feel, tell other people these lies about ourselves in order to protect predators, in order to protect abusers. And so thank you so much for creating this space for survivors. And I guess I'll just kind of start off with some background and dive into my crazy little life story.
Please do. And thank you for being here.
Thank you for being here with me. So I am one of two daughters, the youngest daughter of two extremely hardworking parents that were both the first people in their families to go to college. They are both alcoholics. My dad and his family was raised in a Catholic church and in Catholic schools with regular Catholic punishment. My mom was brought up in a very Baptist home. So my upbringing, while my parents were married for the first 6 years of my life, was a lot of physical and emotional abuse that I was witnessing my dad, place towards my mom, as well as us. It was more towards my mom at that point because we were so young. There was so much tension and hatred and aggression in the marriage. My physical safety was definitely always a question growing up. I grew up parenting myself, my sister being just barely 2 years older than me, we're dealing with screaming fits, objects being thrown at each other, parents leaving, one parent leaving the home and us asking, are they coming back? And them saying, oh, I have no idea. Who knows? That type of instability. So I'm dealing with that until age six, when my parents, tell us that they're going to be getting a divorce. It was at first, the first thing that went through my mind when they were sitting us down was that I thought that they were going to be sending my sister and I to an orphanage, because I thought, which doesn't even exist in America in that way, right? There are shelters and foster homes and things like this. But, you know, in my little kid brain, me and my sister always fighting because of the instability. And so I immediately thought, okay, we're about to be sent away out of our home. My parents are like, no, we're just getting a divorce. There's almost a relief even at 6 years old, because I'm like, oh, things are going to be maybe a little better. Well, now that I have distance from it, you know, I have the awareness that it's like my mother left her two very vulnerable daughters with a very physically aggressive man. And so that I basically spent the next 10 years of my life from ages 6 to 16 going back and forth from one house to the next every week. That was obviously super dysregulating and destabilizing, but you know, I grew up in a home where I went to a private school. I had resources. I always had a home over my head. I always had food on the table, but my parents were working day and night. I was dropped off at school at the earliest moment. Me and my sister were the very last ones picked up at the after school program every day. And then when we got old enough to start taking care of ourselves, so at I was about 7, 8 years old, so maybe 1 to 2 years after the divorce, my parents were like, all right, well, let's hire, you know, a babysitter to drive our girls around, pick them up from school, take them home. That way they can take care of themselves, parent themselves, whatnot. So the first abusive person that entered my life was actually a 20-year-old male babysitter who was a neighbor. And he was renting out the basement apartment in the house directly next door to me. And in the full home next door to me, like in the home that the family was living in, it was these two kids that I grew up with. I'm still in contact with one of them today. One of them sadly has passed on. But it was me and my sister and these two kids that were kind of all being babysat by this 20-year-old man. So I'll just do a little foreshadowing here. My sister, who is 32 years older than me, this is the only man that has ever been in her life. She is still with this man. He was our babysitter from the point when I was 7.5 years old. She was 9.5 years old. And to this day, she and her one friend from high school, who's a female that he has allowed her to have, those two women bought a home with their own money, live in a home with him, where he is the head man who is taken care of and just manipulates and abuses these women that have literally not had the chance to think for themselves since they were children. So I was never sexually abused by this man, but he did attempt to groom me. He attempted to groom the other young girl that we were growing up with. Her mother, who was renting him the basement apartment, forbid him from seeing her kids. Two other families in the neighborhood moved out of the neighborhood because of this man. So many crazy things. So that was the first abuser that was introduced into my life, was this babysitter who was, became the sexual abuser of my sister. And then this was the man who was, you know, taking care of me in the hours that my parents weren't there.
Okay. Can I just,
yeah,
just need a minute. Woo. So this person, you were 7, 8, 9 years old, and your sister was 2 years older than you.
Yes. Yes.
So this 20-year-old was supposed to take care of you, help you, because your parents were unable to or didn't want to, whatever. And he sexually abused your sister, and she's in a relationship with him now. Did I understand that correctly? And now they're living together?
Yeah. And so this is what I will say. I don't know of any, you know, I can't sit here because of this estrangement between me and my sister, which I will get more in depth in, because she has experienced her own abuse. She went on to then blame me for my abuse that I will go into detail about. And so I don't have a relationship with her. I don't speak with her, but, you know, I can't say if he abused her sexually or not when we were children. But this is what I can say, is that he emotionally, spiritually manipulated her. He claims to be a practicing Buddhist monk, drew her into that. They still, you know, practice that. And in that, he taught her to judge other people. Anyone that makes different decisions than you is wrong. People that use drug and alcohol are wrong. People that have sex are wrong, even though obviously they went on to have a sexual relationship in a very manipulative, abusive, fucked up way. So, you know, I can't say that he sexually abused her, but there was a lot of covert sexual abuse. I mean, inappropriate handholding, inappropriate time spent together, like so much special attention, little gifts, little nicknames, taking pictures of all of the children, always wanting to make home movies with us and stuff like this. So, I mean, there, that is sexual abuse. We can go ahead and say that's sexual abuse right there.
It definitely sounds like grooming. It definitely sounds like
it is hardcore grooming. And so, you know, whether or not there were physical lines crossed before my sister was 18 years old, it's like, that's whatever. In my opinion, she has never been given the chance to make her own decisions. And as someone who has been, deeply affected by the long-term effects of sexual abuse and how it makes you view yourself, how you enter relationships, how you enter sexual encounters, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that there is any consent in that relationship, regardless of her now being an adult and regardless of them having, some sort of adult relationship. So
I mean, the age gap was like plus 10 years. If he was 20 and she was 2 years older than you, so she must have been around like what, 9, 10? So I mean, a 10-year-old girl being educated by a 20-year-old, he had massive influence, he had a massive impact on what she believed in, because he was more or less the father figure, because the father, it sounds like, wasn't much there, neither was the mother. So he could
you hit it right on the head with these people.
Yeah, he could mold her into being exactly who he wanted,
and he's done a damn good job, because
here
we are decades later, and unfortunately she's still stuck in that situation. So, you know, I have all of the empathy in the world for her, but unfortunately, because of decisions that she has made and things that she said to me, she is no longer in my life. But I do feel that relationship between them, this relationship between me and my sister, this obviously deeply impacted, you know, my life, as well as the way that things continued to go. And so basically how things continued to go was that after 2 years of a divorce, my mom got remarried to a man that I had met once. And this had been years prior, when she was still married to my dad, was at the time that I met this man. So I never met him in the context of anything until we moved in with him 2 weeks after my mom told me that we would be doing so. So she says, hello, I've been dating this man, even though I haven't brought him around, you haven't met him, and he lives in a nice house, so we're going to move in with him. And so, and they were engaged shortly after that, And so shortly after we moved in with this man, I developed insomnia. I would sleep with all the lights on. I became extremely insecure. I started, you know, I usually didn't have a problem going back and forth between my mom and dad's house. I mean, of course, that's incredibly destabilizing, but I was never really the one to be like, oh, I'm going to cry because I miss my mom or cry because I miss my dad. But I distinctly remember that as soon as my mom moved into this home, even though it was nice and on a lake and I had my own big room, the days that I had to go over to my mom's house, I started to cry. And I didn't know what all this was about. I didn't know what this insomnia was about. You know, I'm just tired all the time. And I mean, this is at 8 years old. And so, meanwhile, this is all going on for me. I don't know what's happening. At my dad's house, every other week that I'm there, there's, you know, abuse happening in its own way of like these intense militaristic standards of perfection, where basically we had such an intense daily routine, me and my sister, because the routine was to set us up to help him parent us. So, you know, going through, I don't know what at my mom's house yet, going through intense, intense rules at my dad's house, including rules such as you can't lock your room, the door to your room, because I need to have full control. And so then this is a rule that, you know, I take over to my mom's house. It's like, oh, well, I guess I don't need to lock my door because I'm a kid. Meanwhile, wish I had been locking my door all along because, you know, years go on, I'm developing a closer relationship with this man who I was beginning to know as my stepfather, who was my abuser, my first abuser. And, you know, as I start to go through puberty, we start to, you know, develop a super close relationship. All of a sudden, he's extremely interested in me. Oh, he wants to drive me around to my extracurricular activities. Oh, he wants me to kiss him on the lips. You know, these things that could possibly be normal in other loving homes, but, you know, these were not normal. And, you know, to me, because I have distant, emotionally neglectful parents that have told me, you know, that if I cry, I'm too dramatic, that as a small child, if I'm not paying attention in school, that, you know, I'm never going to turn out well and I'm going to end up just like all of my, you know, parents' alcoholic siblings. And so, you know, I start to look at this man as my one, you know, stable parent. And then I am 13 years old and I awake in the middle of the night very clearly to him in my room, touching me, speaking to me. And everything clicks. I remember all of these other times where I had seen shadows in my room in the night, times I'd fallen asleep on the sofa downstairs and woken up to him in the room somewhere, all of these little stories that he would tell where, oh, I sleepwalk at night to eat ice cream and I leave drips of ice cream on the floor so I have a story to cover up. So this is the first time that I am like conscious, waking up fully, being like, holy shit, this is happening. You know, for years before this, I'm only 13 years old and I've been experiencing depression, self-harm, suicidal ideation. People are telling me I'm attention seeking. When I'm self-harming, I'm even doing in a way to hide. So I don't seem attention seeking, even though what did I desperately need? Attention, care, love. And so this last time where I was being sexually abused, where I woke up to it, and all of these very clear memories, you know, start to come back to me. I run first into the bathroom that's right off of my room. and I close myself in there, and I'm so dissociated. You know, is this real? Am I real? Do I walk out of this door and confront this abuser and face, I don't know what, more sexual violence, death, I don't know, or do I jump out of this three-story window? And that was the first time that suicide had crossed my mind, was as a 13-year-old girl, as a means to escape this predator. And I open the door from the bathroom. He's standing there. He, you know, kind of forces me back into my room. And somehow I'm able to get in the room. And then, you know, more inappropriate things happen. And that's when I bolt out of the room, bolt to my mom's room. And I'm screaming. And she's saying, what, what? And I just start saying, there's a rapist. Even though he hadn't been raping me, that is the first thing that my brain went to, because my body knew this was the intention. This has been the intention. And, you know, even though this half-dressed man comes into the room after me, I'm still questioned. I'm immediately told it's a bad dream. I run downstairs all the way to the basement to where my sister's room was. And, she's heard me screaming and she's saying, what's going on? My mom has followed me into the basement and hears me recount the exact same story to my sister. And I'm like, we gotta go. We have to go. I'm scared for all of us. He's gonna kill us. Like, we have to go. Mm-hmm. Everyone's so calm. Like, everyone is like so eerily calm. And so this resolves in no one coming with me. My mom driving me to my dad's house in the middle of the night in the abuser's car, where I go to my dad's house and I recount the exact same story to him. And that began a lifelong process of my abusive, neglectful family trying to silence me, trying to hide their missteps and blame me and any sort of acting out behavior, even any sort of normal teenage behavior, on me being bad, me having this excuse about it. So that was obviously incredibly hard. Immediately after the experience with my stepdad and my mom not believing me, you know, she basically says, okay, so, you know, wake up the next morning, dad has to go to work, I'm left alone in the house. So I'm just like, I mean, left alone all day, as I usually am. It's the first day of summer break. So I was actually my best friend was supposed to have spent the night this upcoming evening. And I call her. This woman is still in my life to this day. I was just texting her this morning and I love her. Mm-hmm. And I told her what happened. And I said, yeah, we can't have the sleepover at my mom's house because this is what happened. And she has been the first, you know, believer in me. And I'm so grateful that I have her as someone who has lived through this experience with me, because I'm sure, as you know, as a complex trauma survivor, when we are gaslit about these experiences, which I'm about to go very in depth into, we start to question our own story and our own truth.
Yeah.
And the physical, emotional, spiritual, psychological effects of this are earth-shattering. People take their lives over it. Women were institutionalized for decades because of hysteria, aka the symptoms of complex trauma and sexual violence and abuse.
Yeah.
And so this is crazy that here I am, 30 years old, and this is like the first time that I'm sitting down telling my story, because this is the effects of years of silencing. Creates disease, it creates disharmony, it creates true mental illness. And to be able to see your truth after a lifetime and a society that has been conditioned to sympathize with the abuser and to silence the victim, it is life-changing to be breaking the silence.
It is. There is something, I actually don't even know what word I want to, I don't know which word to use, but it is, it's something else. There's something, just the first time you stand up and speak your truth, there's something very special about that first time. And you know that once you've done it once, there's no going back. You're never going to stay silent again. You're going to continue to speak, and you'll never accept anyone silencing you again. That was my experience, at least.
And, absolutely.
It's daunting. It's frightening. And you get all these thoughts. What if the abuser listens to this podcast? What if the abuser listens to shows up to one of my speaking events, reads my autobiography, all these things? I've been there. I've thought all the worst case scenarios. I understand the fear that comes with stepping into your light. And I really applaud you for what you're doing right now. I'm so proud of you. From one survivor to another, I'm so incredibly proud of you. And I'm so incredibly sorry that you had all these horrible experiences. I mean, child sexual abuse is just the worst. It fucks you up on all levels. And that no one supported you. You literally told two adults and none of them held space for you and believed you. And as someone who, not to go into my story, but experienced something extremely traumatic. I mean, there's been so many things, but there was this episode when I was 14 and I went to the woman that was supposed to be my foster mother, and she turned around and said, "That's your own fault." I know the pain of not being held after going through something that traumatic. So I'm so sorry on your behalf.
Thank you, Jasmine. And I'm sorry for you. I mean, your story has also touched me deeply, and it is why it is so important to be talking about this, because everyone always wants to say, well, why didn't you tell anyone?
Yeah.
Here we are.
Yeah.
If a survivor hasn't outrightly told someone, they have made a desperate attempt to be heard in some way.
Yeah.
And were silenced.
Yeah.
And it's not okay.
No.
And so thank you for understanding that and for telling me that it's not okay. Like, I already feel, you know, I had so much energy just swirling inside of me, you know, leading up to this conversation, even though, you know, these are things that I'm working on. I'm talking about, I'm in therapy. I have a wonderful partner I talk with. I have supportive friends that I talk with. I now have other survivors in the community like you that I talk with, but, you know, to be like, I'm going to tell my whole story, you know, page one to page, I don't even know how many is, yeah, the energy was, there's still so much and so much trauma that I went through and so much abuse that I went through that I'll go into detail about, but just getting through this moment where I was silenced for decades and voicing that and having that come up, like, I internally, there's already a shift. there's already like a change of pace with my internal energy. So thank you for everything about this process. This is so cool.
You're so, so welcome. I mean, being witnessed and not just someone looking at you while you speak. No, someone actively listening and seeing you. That is medicine. And I actually had that experience, I had that, I don't know, was it 2 to 3 years ago? Where someone looked at me and was like, with both her arms, banged them down in the table. And she was just, it is never the child's fault. It is never the child's fault. And that to me, it just imprinted in my entire nervous system. I was like, holy fuck. This is what someone should have said to me when I was 14 years old. This is what someone should have said to me the first time I spoke up about the sexual abuse. I can't remember how old I was. Maybe it was the first time I told my foster mom. Maybe I was 8, 9. I don't know. But this is what it feels like to be seen. So I remember that pivotal moment. It is medicine. And it's something that your system remembers to be seen, what it feels like. Yeah.
Absolutely. The people on my treatment team that I have now have all done that. In some capacity or another. And as you said, like, that is the medicine. Like, yeah, I go get acupuncture. Yeah, I go get body work. Yeah, I go to therapy and do EMDR. But like, people saying that they see me and that wasn't okay and that they believe me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is where the healing comes in. And that is, you know, I have dedicated myself to body work. I'm a massage therapist, and I'll go into that a little bit more later. But, you know, I cannot stress the importance enough of healthcare practitioners, doctors, PAs, nurses, just the ones that are willing to hear you out, repeat back to you what you said, and believe you. Yeah. There is like more medicine in that than like a bottle of prescription drugs.
Yeah.
So, thank you for space. And I'm going to keep it going.
Yes, please do. And I'm going to be right by your side cheering on you. I'm going to be, yes, yes, woman, yes. Speak, speak.
Yes, I can heal it. Okay, so after coming out about this sexual abuse at 13 years old, like I said, it's the beginning of summer break. And so typically, you know, I'd be going back and forth between homes, between my mom and my dad's house. But obviously I'm like, all right, well, I can't go back to that home, right? That's the abuser's home. And that's just fine by my mom, because my mom continues to not believe me, and the abuser goes on to gaslight me for, I think, 2 to 3 weeks, including there was a point where I needed to go back to that house to get some of my things, and my mom brought me there, and there was a letter sitting on the counter that he had written that said something along the lines of, "Dear Monica, I can't believe that you would tell this lie and damage our relationship like this. Like, I hope that you like right your wrongs," or something. This is what a grown man typed out on a computer, printed out, and left on his counter for his sexual abuse victim as a 13-year-old girl to have to read. So my mom gives me that letter. So, you know, just more messaging of like, you're wrong. It was, whatever happened was your fault. What did actually happen? Was it that bad? This is what my mom still believes to this day is that he invaded my privacy. That's how she labels this sexual abuse. And so, you know,
okay, that's a nice way to bypass it.
I was like, that's a really nice way to bypass it.
Yeah.
So after about 3 weeks of me not letting up about my truth, he realizes that I'm not going back on it. So he tells whatever version of his story it is. I'm sure a completely watered down version. And so then my mom believes him. So then I have to deal with, you know, I've been at my dad's house for weeks at this point, which is like very atypical. So then my mom picks me and my sister up and takes us to a pool where she, that we've never been to before, where she cries and is like, he like told sort of the truth or whatever. He invaded your privacy, told the truth about invading your privacy. So then I'm sitting there watching my mom bawl publicly. And that begins the start of me stuffing everything down, blaming myself. My sister started that out really strongly, though, the week after I came out about the sexual abuse. I think it was 3 days after, she decided to say, well, you know, you do walk around in your sports bra all the time. As a 12 and 13 year old child, I'd walk around in my home in a sports bra. And again, just there's that victim blaming mentality where a grown man is out of control of his body and therefore needs to be sexually violent towards a small child. So after he told his really, you know, watered down version of the truth, he also told, you know, his justification was, I guess, that he was addicted to porn. And so my mom goes, okay, well, I need to be with him. He's going to go through a 30-day porn addiction, you know, treatment program, which, as most victims of sexual abuses have experienced, porn addiction, masturbation addiction, like all these crazy justifications for people being sexually violent. So my mom straight up told me then that she needed to support him and that I would be like living with my dad while she supported him through that process.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Talk about slap in the face, punch in the gut. I mean, I have to support him for harming you. That infuriates me. I'm like, what fucking planet are you on, mother? Do you remember you birthed me? I'm your child.
Yes. There are so many parts of me that, you know, I have to stop myself from asking these questions of biological answering of how do you do this to your child?
Yeah.
Like, I have two dogs and a cat that if someone looked at them the wrong way, I'd be like, eh.
Yeah.
You know, so much as two children that you consciously bring into this world, so much so, Jaslyn, me and my sister's birthdays are 5 days apart. They're a year and 360 days apart because we were planned around my mother's marathon running season. So it's like, you planned these babies.
Yeah.
And you abandoned them.
Yeah.
And you neglected them. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and make excuses for my mother. You know, I really resonated with a lot of what Sula Lubin said, you know, when she would be like, you know, I'm not sitting here making excuses for my mother, but it's like, my mother had been through one divorce with a violent man. She grew up in a Baptist, really religious home. She got divorced, you know, this is like the 90s. This is before divorce is every other relationship that's happening. And the amount of insecurity and all of the things that could be wrapped up in my mother needing to abandon her own children, to choose an abusive predator over them so that she would not be alone, so that she would not have to go through a divorce again, so that she would not have to find another partner again, so that she wouldn't have to, you know, hire more help parenting her children. The list goes on and on for excuses for my mother. I don't think she needs any, but I want to highlight them because I think it's important when we talk about the systemic nature of oppression, religion, trauma. And I think her and my dad were both responsible for breaking the cycle, and they didn't. They perpetuated the cycle. But I just want to highlight that because I will be talking about more things within her relationships and my own relationships that are tied to women tying their worth to men and needing to be around men to feel safe and protected from other men and the mind fuck that happens with that is wild.
It is.
So basically, after, you know, my mother spent time taking care of the abuser and I spent time not being taken care of at all, just on summer break alone all day every day, you know, the school year was starting up again. Can't live like this forever. My parents only want to parent half the time. At this point, at this age, not only had, you know, my sister and I had a tumultuous relationship because of all the instability within our home that created competition between us, but she was 2 years older than me. And so she had decided that she didn't want to live in my dad's home anymore because of his physical aggression and the abuse that we would, you know, you got to choose one abusive home over the other. So my sister was like, well, I don't really care about continuing to live with my mom and the abuser. Like, I'll do that. She had no problem with it. I told my mom, I'm not going back to that house. Not going to live in that house. Not going back to that house. Not happening. Her recommendations are that she can have someone come cleanse the negative energy out of the home.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm sitting here as a massage therapist with all my candles and my cleansing tools. And it's like, you can't cleanse predators out of a home. It's not how abuse works.
You need a fucking exorcism. You need, I mean, to pull that devil out of the human that's possessed him to molest children, that's an exorcism, like not an energy cleanse, not a crystal ceremony. No, we need to drag that fucking demon out of the human that made him dirty. Yeah. I mean, what planet was your mother on? It sounds delusional. I'm sorry, I know it's your mother, but it's like,
no.
Wake up.
This is the exact right word to use for her, is a delusion. So this began her living in an alternate reality. Because of how much dissociation that I've dealt with as a complex trauma survivor, I'm able to recognize how much she deals with that and was dealing with that.
Yeah.
I mean, this woman literally speaks in a different voice now permanently. And so I told her cleansing the energy out of the house wasn't going to work. She brought me to a psychic, which again, definitely think there are people that are tapped in to that, but you know, this woman didn't do anything for my little sexually assaulted, unsafe child self. So I'm like, yeah, mom, that isn't going to cut it either. So her compromise is she starts renting homes, and then they rented an apartment for him, like right down the street. Yeah. And then after like a year or two of doing that, she finally bought a home, and then they bought an apartment for him like down the street from that home. And so then when I wasn't living in that home, he would come and live in that home. And every week that I'd be at my mom's house, I mean, I'd be at school all day. I'd get home from school and she'd go, bye. I'm going to my husband's apartment. See you later.
Wow.
So that was, you know, ages 13, 14, 15, 16. You know, I start acting out in all the ways a child would act out. My homes are full of alcohol because my parents are alcoholics. So I'm like, perfect. So I had actually started drinking before my awareness of the sexual abuse, because as I had mentioned, you know, this sexual abuse started at 8 years old when I moved into the home, but it wasn't until me waking up very distinctly at 13 years old that these pieces started to be put together. And it wasn't even until super recently that me confronting these repressed emotions actually brought up more repressed memories of the abuse. But yeah, I start acting out. I start drinking. My parents are pissed. They can't, they just ground me. But like, there's alcohol in the house. I just keep drinking. I start experimenting with drugs. I start having normal, what I would like to think of normal, but there's obviously a lot of questions around consent being a sexual assault survivor. But, you know, I start engaging in normal young boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, relationships around 12, 13 years old. I'm hardcore shamed for these. I'm like allowed to have them, but I'm very shamed for them. I'm shamed for, you know, starting to act out in any way. I'm shamed for self-harm when that's discovered. I'm shamed for, you know, sending sad messages to friends on the computer that end up being found. There's, you know, my parents are so angry every time they find me acting out, and they can't figure out why. And so the more I start acting out, the more I am getting punished at my dad's home. So I start to become afraid to go there. So what's my other option? To go to my mom's house. Okay, well, I tell her, you know, I want to start living with you more because I'm afraid of dad. She understands. That's why she left my dad. And also her two children with him. Still so confused about that. But, you know, I'm like, all right, I kind of want to maybe live with you more. The more I'm getting in trouble, the more I'm getting grounded. You know, you don't really have many rules at your house because you're too busy, you know, having a love affair with your husband, who's my abuser. And so my parents are at a loss of what to do because they don't know how to parent, and they never have before. And so my mom goes, okay, well, like, if you want to live here more, I need my husband to live with us because I need his support because you're going through a lot and it's a lot for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really all about mommy, isn't it? There's not much concern for the humans she brought into the world, but there's a lot of concern about herself, her needs, her wants, her desires, what's best for her.
And whenever there was dysfunction between me or my sister, or whenever as a small child, because of repeated abuse and sexual abuse, I would be emotionally distraught and depressed and falling to pieces, her reaction is to sob and ask why she's such a bad mother.
Oh, no. I cannot with that.
And it seems to be such a through line with children who experience sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Is this mother who refuses to mother, refuses to parent.
Yes.
And insists that the child parent her and make her feel good.
Yeah. And what I also am hearing is playing the victim, which is also, that's just my story. That's why I had such a big reaction to her reaction. That is playing the victim. That is, you know, changing the focus on her rather than focusing that she has a child that's obviously in distress. This is something I also don't understand. I don't understand that parents, teachers, social workers, when they see a child acting out and having these quote-unquote extreme behaviors, that these people do not know this is a cry for help. It is always a cry for help. There is always a reason as to why someone is behaving in extreme ways. And I just don't understand why no one sits down with this child and ask, what is happening inside of you? Are you upset? Are you hurting? Why is no one talking to this child? I was the same. I was bouncing off walls. I was wild. I would beat the shit out of my classmates. I was extremely violent because I was living through extreme violence. And I would just like your story, I would be shamed. No one sat me down and was like, Jaslyn, what is happening here? What is this? What's going on?
My sister would often, because she was older than me and she's incredibly intelligent, she would often, you know, say these very mean things to me when I was a child and we were fighting. And then my reaction, similar to yours, was, yeah, I was very physically aggressive, particularly with her. And because physical aggression is a no-no, I always got the talking to and the punishment, as opposed to discipline. And discipline doesn't always have to be negative. Discipline can be, why are you acting like this? Let's talk about this, you know? And yeah, I think you said it exactly correctly. You know, these cries for help, they are true. They're not exaggerated. I think something that is an interesting perspective to have is, you know, when someone with complex PTSD or a serious mental health disability or disorder is having an emotional breakdown, you know, that might look crazy, it might look extreme, it might look out of this world to so many people, but I believe that extreme reaction is an appropriate reaction to the amount of abuse that person had to endure. Maybe it's not coming out at the right time. Maybe it's coming out because you stubbed your toe. And then all of a sudden, that spot on the wall where you stubbed your toe is representing people that were physically violent towards you for years. And so then you have a full mental breakdown. But these extreme reactions, they are, the more that I'm healing and allowing myself to have them and move through these emotions, I realize they're not extreme. My story was extreme, and these emotions seem congruent with my lived experience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree with you.
And
you know,
I would love to see, you know, a perspective, like what I loved about the moments we shared before we started the recording was that you said you welcome expression in all of its forms. And again, it's just like that is part of being human.
It is.
We are an instrument of expression. That's why we have all these fingers and toes and a voice box and bodies and tears. We are supposed to be expressing ourselves. And when we are silenced and we shove that down, it creates disease and it creates disharmony in the body and the mind and the spirit. And it starts to fracture a person. And then this person is not, these people who are affected heavily by complex trauma are not able to find their self because they don't know what the truth is. We've been gaslit about our truth. We've been gaslit about how we should be made to feel about our abuse. Some of the things that my mom said to me to, you know, try to manipulate and try to turn the situation around in her favor were, you know, when I was into performing arts, I went to performing arts high school and I was in a lot of productions. And every time she came to a production, you know, she'd be so sad and she'd say, you know, it's just so uncomfortable for me to be here alone. Like everyone's asking me where my husband is or if I have a husband and I just have to, you know, say that I'm here alone. And
oh
it's like,
my God.
No one's asking you that. All these parents are here for their children to support their children at their high school drama play. No one's wondering where your husband is. So, you know, as the gaslighting continues, it starts to become a more personal and it starts to become more my fault. And so as I start to shift towards, okay, yeah, I'm acting out and I'm getting a lot of punishment and I'm scared of going to dad's house because of the abuse that's happening there. So mom, can I come to your house? And she's saying, you know, she needs the abuser to come and support her. And at this point, I'm just so at odds with everything, myself, my life, my story, what's truth, what's lies, that I'm like, fine, have him come fucking live here. So in the like month that he lived in that house, everything exploded. And you know, there wasn't, he definitely tried to manipulate. He tried to groom. He tried to get in physical contact with me. And because of turmoil between my biological parents and me not seeing my dad and my dad trying to come to my mom's house and show up and see me to see if I'm okay and to have screaming matches with my mom, you know, there was a moment where I relied on this abuser again because I was so fucking scared and didn't know what to do. And my parents were fighting, screaming at the door at each other. My stepmom even showed up and was like, y'all need to parent your fucking kid. I love that woman. She doesn't have any of her own children, but she believes in me and my story and did the best a stepmom could do. So after a lot of me acting out, me having to live with this man again, my parents keep saying, okay, if you make one more misstep, if you miss one more class, if you self-harm again, if we drug test you when we see you're using drugs again, if we find another bottle of alcohol in your room, you know, we're going to send you away. That's the next plan. We're going to send you away. So of course I'm dealing with complex trauma and I have many missteps, you know, and my parents do send me away. So this is the period of my life where I enter what is called the troubled teen industry. And it's an entire money-hungry industry that is dedicated to, you know, making money off of struggling youth that have enough money and resources to exploit. And so the first stage of the troubled teen industry for me was my parents said, we're sending you to a wilderness program. You're going to be living in the woods for 30 days, backpacking, and then you'll come back home. I'm like, so, you know, been dealing with complex trauma for years, dissociation for years, abusive homes my entire life. I'm like, whatever, just get me out of these fucking homes. You know, at this point, this has, I should definitely highlight why sending me away had been the decision. The more I was acting out as a teenager, you know, I'm starting to like, trying to like pack bags and get out of houses and like do this type of stuff. And so the way my parents start dealing with me is they start calling the cops on me in their home, calling the cops to come deal with me. Okay, so the last time they call the cops on me, my mother and the abuser are in the home. I'm trying to leave the home. I'm 16 years old. It's the same cop they've been calling. I don't know if they have this guy on speed dial or what, but he shows up and I'm like, do you want to know the real problem that's happening in this home? Is that I'm being sexually abused by that man in there. And no one's doing anything about that. I was sent to a wilderness program 3 days later. To the middle of the woods, actually. Very close to where I live now. And I, again, was told I was going to be there for 30 days, backpacking. I'd come back home. I was there for 77 days in the middle of the winter for Christmas, New Year's, and my birthday, living underneath a plastic tarp, backpacking to a new location every day. While I was at that program, I was put through psychological evaluation. And different scholastic testing. I don't really know what's going on with this. I'm just like, okay, this psychological tester is like, sweetie, this is a safe place. Why don't you tell me your story? So I tell her my story. The next week in this wilderness program, I get a letter from each of my parents. You know, that psych tester told both of them everything I had told her. So that was, you know, a huge breach of trust with a therapist, because my story is so crazy. I left out a massive breach of trust with a therapist that I would like to highlight. As I was, you know, trying to speak out about this sexual abuse from my stepdad, my mom thought a really good way to kind of control and manipulate the situation was be to select a therapist who would be compassionate, but like not believe me and would side with my mother. And so right before I started living with the abuser again, my therapist and my mom thought it'd be a great idea to have the abuser show up surprise to a therapy session, come into the room with me and read me a 3-page letter, crying his eyes out about how I should forgive him.
Oh my God, I cannot even. And how old was you when this
happened? I was, I believe, 15, 16 years old at that time.
But I mean, I just can't even, you cannot do that to a child. How are you supposed, how, I mean, just living through the sexual abuse in itself, that's one massive thing that just, you know, it wrecks you. It messes you up on so many levels for the rest of your life. Well, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yes. Speaking, I'm gonna go ahead and
in my thirties. So, but it's long term. That's my point. And then you are in puberty. You are supposed to come into yourself, coming to who you are. You're going through massive hormonal shifts, psychological development, and you're supposed to be able to navigate through that type of conversation. You don't even have the emotional maturity to navigate something that difficult. And even if you had, let me just say that, even if you had, no victim is supposed to, in my opinion, no matter how fucking intelligent they are, they should not sit across their abuser and having to witness their emotional expression and having to deal with the feelings of the of the abuser, because you're emotionally wrecked yourself. Why the fuck would you want to sit and listen to what the abuser has to say? That's maybe something with the age we have now, or we would, if we wanted to, because we have a different maturity now and we have more life experience. So we could be like, okay, I'm actually willing to sit down with this person and listen and ask him questions like, why the fuck did you do that? Why did you touch me? What was going on? Where were you in your right mind? But when you're 15, 16 in my case, you don't have the capacity to, or even the communicative skills to navigate through a conversation like that. So I'm just so confused as to why this bloody therapist would even suggest, think that that was a brilliant idea, because it seems so unprofessional and it seems extremely inconsiderate and violent.
It is, and it was. And this is why she wanted to do that, is because my mother selects therapists that are going to believe her version of her story. Mm-hmm. And she also typically selects therapists that are self-pay, that don't take insurance. And not to say that all therapists that don't take insurance have malicious intentions. Everyone has their own boundaries, but I will say in the therapist that my mother brought me to, I didn't see an ethical one, and I saw many. Mm-hmm. And the sexual abuse was never something that was discussed. And I just so resonate with everything that you were just saying. And I think anyone that has the capacity to do things like sit in a room with their abuser or sit in a courtroom and try to, you know, convict their abuser, I mean, amazing, like incredible strength, bravery, courage, because here you and I are sitting decades later and we are just now being able to talk about this, being believed about this, and being supported in this. And I'm sure with the support, as there always is in these contexts, there is going to be the haters and the people that are victim blamers.
Oh, 1,000%. I feel like that comes with it comes with, you know, stepping into your lights. There are definitely going to be people that are going to point at you and be like, oh, you're doing this to get attention, and you should have, and why didn't you, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it pisses me off, but there's also a part of me that's becoming very indifferent. And there's a part of me that's like, you're ignorant. Shut up.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are people that are, you know, and especially as a complex trauma survivor, I am passionate about humanitarian issues. I'm passionate about racial justice. I'm passionate about environmental justice. Like, these are things that I cannot close my eyes to. And I think as someone who is living my truth, it's, you know, I'm always ready to change my opinion when exposed to the newest information, the newest science, a new perspective. Obviously, I am intelligent and have my own ways where I'm like, okay, well, am I going to take, how much am I going to weigh this perspective? But, you know, we all have our own devices of measuring that, but I think there are people that are, you know, gonna blame victims, and it's coming from a place of societal conditioning. Mm-hmm. And then there are gonna be people that are gonna blame victims because that's they believe that in mm-hmm. their core. Mm-hmm. And those people usually have their own cycles that they're perpetuating themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's see where I left off here. So basically, you know, gaslit and just put in this horribly unsafe, you know, situation in this therapist's office that I had grown to trust, even though, you know, we didn't ever actually talk about anything. It was a woman that I, you know, trusted. And then she brings my sexual abuser into the room. And then fast forward, like not too much later, to where I'm in this wilderness program doing this psychological testing. The therapist tells me I can trust her. She divulges my life story to my parents, who then are writing me these letters telling me, well, we knew some of this stuff, but fuck you for all these other things. And we can't wait to punish you more when you get out. So on my 17th birthday, I found out that my parents had been working with what's called an educational consultant, which is someone I'd never met before, but it's a person who makes a lot of money to take kids from wilderness therapy programs, residential treatment centers, and mental hospitals, and place them into very expensive residential treatment centers that have the disguise of, you know, a preparatory boarding school or a therapeutic boarding school. Mm-hmm. So I found out on my 17th birthday that indeed I was not coming home, and that I'd be spending more time in the woods, and that I would also be going to an institution called Carl Brook, which is no longer open due to abuse and neglect charges and all sorts of court cases. And I will go ahead and say it is under the Synonym school system. There is a lot of information about this school system, but it is a cult program that was spread by rich white guys across the United States. I believe that the program was developed around the 70s, and then they started to open these schools in the 80s and 90s. And so they opened all of these Synonym schools or CEDU schools that were all cults based around these extremely fucked up, manipulative, spiritual bypassing version of therapy. There were no licensed therapists at these schools. They were called advisors. So that's mm-hmm. how I believe they got away with it. So on my 17th birthday, found out I was going to be finishing high school from Carl Brook. I originally was slated to graduate after 16 months, but had my stay extended for 19 months. And there is a lot of information out there about Synonym schools and all of the details. And there's documentaries and YouTube videos and books written. So I won't get like too into it, but I will talk about some of the things that I experienced there.
May I just ask a question before you go into it? Is it like one of those boarding schools that, you know, have you seen the Paris Hilton documentary? She was sent to a school.
It is,
and she was
very,
abused.
Very much like that. Yes.
Because I was sent to boarding school too, but my experience was different. I mean, I was abused, but not what Paris Hilton she experienced. I mean, I have no words.
So
I just wanted to know if it was similar.
Yes, I haven't seen her documentary, but I'm still in contact with a lot of the alumni, and a lot of the people are like, wasn't her program very similar to ours? There is I will say there's a documentary on Hulu that is called The Synonym Fix. And that is like Carl Brook, the school I went to was a synonym school. So like, if you want to hear about in detail some of that more than what I'll get into, there is tons of information out there.
Oh my God. I'm going to see that because I'm obsessed with documentaries like that. Because I just don't understand all this sickness in our society.
It is crazy.
Yeah, so it is mad.
Let me preface by saying Carl Brook was, I mean, absolutely insane. It was abusive. I met some really great people there that I'm still in contact with. I met some really lost souls there who are still lost. But this was basically the setup. It was a boarding school in the middle of Halifax, Virginia. There was nothing around. Multiple students ran from this school, Jaslyn, and were never found again.
No bloody way. Stop right now.
So frequently, students would try to run. At wilderness programs and any residential treatment center, this is typical. Children run. Frequently, they're able to recover them. Usually, these programs work closely with the local law enforcement so that the law enforcement knows, okay, if you see a child dressed like this in this area, you know, we got to go get them. And so there were multiple times at the school where my friends would run and then they're brought back by cops. But there were several students who ran and were never found.
I mean, where are they? Did they run?
One of them left in the middle of the winter in a snowstorm. And I mean, it's like, yeah, I live in the U.S., but this is rural Virginia. Like, they placed this school in the middle of nowhere for a very specific reason.
Oh, so for that sure they did.
Would not be seen or heard.
That was it for today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to rate Alchemical Voices and follow the community on Instagram. Until next time.